From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Trump are speaking by phone after an earlier in-person meeting between Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She's visiting Russia for the first time in 2 years. The two answered questions from reporters after their meeting, and Chancellor Merkel was asked whether she was concerned about Russia meddling in the German elections later this year.
I believe that we will have no problem during the electoral campaign in Germany, even if there are disagreements.
President Putin also responded to that question.
We never interfere in other countries' politics.
Well, the BBC's Steve Rosenberg joins us from Moscow. And Steve, first of all, how did people react to that when Putin said he never interferes in other countries' politics?
Well, I don't think that Angela Merkel would have been too convinced by that. I think what we heard today at the news conference given by Chancellor Merkel and Vladimir Putin was it was clear there was no meeting of minds. And that's not a surprise. We hadn't been expecting any breakthrough in relations between Russia and Germany, which had been pretty much in the deep freeze for the last 3 years or so. On that question of Russian interference in Western elections, Vladimir Putin denied it, but Chancellor Merkel talked about disinformation. She gave one example of a news story, a negative news story about Germany, which had originated in Russia, which she said was false. And she said if there were more cases of that, then the Germans would look into that. So that was one example of a difference of opinion. There was a difference of opinion over Ukraine, too. Vladimir Putin said that the government in Kiev had come to power through an unconstitutional coup. Chancellor Merkel said no, the government in Kiev had come to power democratically. And so it went on. And so we saw two very different worldviews expressed by Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin.
Does Germany feel threatened militarily by Russia in Eastern Europe, especially given what's been going on in Ukraine?
I don't think it's a question of a military threat. Angela Merkel today talked about a hybrid war. She in that sense, she stood up to Vladimir Putin and talked about it. And I think there is a feeling in Germany, and we've heard that from the head of German foreign intelligence, that the Russians have been making attempts to interfere in Western society. In fact, the intelligence chiefs in Germany believe that a cyber attack on the German government server may have been, in their words, influenced by Russia. I think that's where the Germans believe the threat comes from. And also this question of misinformation, disinformation being spread by Moscow.
Does Merkel have any leverage with Putin on the issues of Syria?
I think it's not clear how much leverage Angela Merkel has at all on Vladimir Putin. There is no love lost between these two leaders. As I say, they have very different views on international affairs. Angela Merkel is seen to be as the defender of Western liberal democracy, of civil society, of the European Union. Vladimir Putin is an authoritarian leader who appears determined to undermine Western liberal democracy and believes that is the right thing to do and wants to weaken the European Union to get EU sanctions removed. So I think Angela Merkel has limited leverage over Vladimir Putin. And that is odd when you consider that she speaks his language. She speaks fluent Russian and he speaks fluent German. And yet, although there is, you know, they have this language thing in common, there's no common language here. As I say, they have two very different views of the world. And there is, I think, a deep suspicion of each other, too.
So which language do they speak when they talk to each other?
Well, I think they probably exchange a few words in each other's language. But the main negotiations are carried on in their native tongues with interpreters.
Mm. Now, Putin is also meeting tomorrow with the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. As we mentioned, he's speaking by phone today with President Trump. Why all these meetings with foreign leaders right now?
Yeah, there does seem to be a flurry of diplomatic activity. The conversation, the telephone conversation with Donald Trump, the meetings with Chancellor Merkel, with President Erdogan, it does seem as if there is some diplomatic effort going ahead to possibly achieve a breakthrough in Syria. But we've seen diplomatic activity before, and we've seen it come to nothing. So I think we have to be very cautious and wait for some announcement. Certainly the Russians believe as far as Syria is concerned, that there has to be a political, peaceful solution to the Syrian conflict, that there is no military solution there. And the Russians, the one thing they don't want to happen is to get bogged down militarily in Syria. So the Russians have made it clear they do want a negotiated settlement. Perhaps the diplomatic activity we're seeing is a reflection of that.
That's the BBC's Steve Rosenberg joining us from Moscow. Steve, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, let's turn now to the police shooting death of a 15-year-old African-American boy in Texas Saturday night. The police chief of Balch Springs, a suburb of Dallas, is now saying that the original police account was wrong. On Sunday morning, officers said a car filled with teenagers was driving towards them in an aggressive manner, so they opened fire. A rifle shot traveled through the passenger side window, killing 15-year-old Jordan Edwards. But after reviewing footage from body cameras, Chief Jonathan Haber determined the car Edwards was in was actually driving away. NPR's Wade Goodwin is following this. Wade, tell us more about what the police said initially on Sunday morning, the morning after the shooting. What was the context?
Well, the context was that, you know, already by Sunday, the family was of Edwards was very upset and calling for an investigation and for the officer to be charged. So they held a press conference, and Chief Haber said that the car, there had been some unknown altercation between officers and the car, or at least with the car. It was a strange way of putting it, and that the car then back toward his officers in what he said was an aggressive manner, and that his officers opened fire on the car, shot into the car, and killed one of the teenagers.
And by the way, the police were in the area because there had been a call about kids drinking, and there was a party there. But here we have that account that the police give, and then we have the chief calling another press conference and saying that, in fact, he looked at body cam footage. That car was not coming towards the officers.
The second press conference was completely different in both tone and content. Chief Haber was visibly upset, emotionally wrought. He said that, in fact, the car, although it initially did back toward the officers, that it stopped, put itself, the driver put the car into drive and was driving away from the officers when the shots were fired. There was no more talk of the car being driven in an aggressive manner, and there were a lot of apologies from the chief, who said at one point that after viewing the video that he was deeply unsure that the shooting met the police department standards.
Yeah, we have heard from the family's lawyer, Lee Merritt, who says the family wants justice. They're comparing this to other high-profile deaths of blacks during encounters with police. Here's his thoughts.
We are declaring war on bad policing. This has happened far too often. We are tired of making the same rhetorical demands.
And Wade, what else are you learning in your reporting?
So we know that a neighbor called the police, not that they knew that there was any underage drinking, but that there were so many cars parked on the block for this party that some of the driveways were being blocked in, and they called that perhaps there might be underage drinking. In fact, the teenagers in the car had not been drinking. They were not armed. When the police originally arrived, the kids scattered. You know, I think the mother was not at home. I don't think there was any drinking going on, but there was a lot of music and partying and dancing, and they ran. And then there were shots fired, and both the boys and the police heard these shots being fired, and that put everybody on edge. The teenagers said that that made them think, let's get out of here. And the police said they heard the shots. And I think the shots being fired, we don't know who fired shots, where they were.
Well, you don't
even
really, you don't even really know if they were shots, do we? I mean, it could have been backfires, anything. Yeah.
It could have been fireworks. We don't know. But both the teenagers and the police felt like there were might have been shots. And so I think that raised the tension level of everything so that the young men were eager to get out of there and the police were on edge.
Well, and this young man was a straight-A student, a standout athlete, beloved by his schoolmates, according to accounts. I mean, this has just got to be devastating there.
Not that this makes any difference, but Jordan Edwards was clearly a rising star at Mesquite High School. 15 years old, he was smart, he was a very talented football player, and he was affable and friendly when the football coach said that when he first arrived, Jordan arrived there within hours in his office to make friends. He wanted to play college football. He was working out all the time. This was a young man who was a rising star at this high school.
We'll continue to follow this story. NPR's Wade Goodwin. The story is of the police shooting of African-American teen Jordan Edwards in Balch Springs, Texas. The police chief there saying the original account of the shooting is wrong. Wade, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Donald Trump is president largely because of how well his campaign did in the Midwest. Trump picked up 50 more electoral votes from the region than Mitt Romney did in 2012, and it helped deliver him to the White House. Politics in many Midwestern states have been turning more conservative for years, and Midwest state houses have become proving grounds for Republican policies from restricting labor unions to expanding gun rights. We're going to take a look now at how Republican governors in the Midwest have changed the national political conversation with John McCormick, a reporter in Bloomberg's Chicago Bureau. Welcome.
Thank you.
And of the 12 states considered to be part of the Midwest, 11 of them have Republican governors right now. We'll talk about some of the policies they've pursued on a state level in a minute. But what do you think in general? How has the Midwest changed the national political conversation?
Well, you know, there have been efforts in certain of these states to pass, you know, things that are popular with the Republican base. I think probably Wisconsin is the biggest shining example for Republicans. Scott Walker there, of course, with his famous crusade against government sector unions in 2011. You know, it has varied from state to state in terms of really how much has been accomplished on the Republican agenda.
Well, let's talk about Wisconsin. You brought that up as a really important one. And let's go back to 2011 when tens of thousands of demonstrators descended on the state capitol in Madison to protest Governor Scott Walker's Act 10, which restricted the collective bargaining rights for most public employees. It sparked an unsuccessful campaign to recall Governor Walker, and it helped launch his unsuccessful presidential bid. Here he is speaking to the Heritage Foundation in 2011.
Well, for us, again, it's about balancing the budget. It has been, will continue to be, and will always be about balancing the budget. But to the extent that we can show the rest of the country that we can lead when it comes to budgetary reform, to fiscal reform, to really tackling the tough issues. But I think in November, voters certainly here in Wisconsin, but I think across the country, elected people to turn things around.
Looking back, do you think that was a watershed moment for conservative politics in the Midwest?
It was certainly an important moment. Another quote from that time, and this speaks to sort of the theme that we're talking about. Walker was recorded in 2011 as part of a sort of a prank phone call, somebody who was posing as David Koch. And Walker said, you know, thinking that he was speaking to David Koch, he said, "This is our time to change the course of history." It hasn't played out to be quite that dramatic. Really, Walker's biggest accomplishment was that fight with the union in 2011, and that's now 6 years old. So he has pushed some other conservative things right to work after saying that he wouldn't do it. And he also has pushed through drug testing for welfare recipients. Walker, I think, has found that you can only push so far in these purple states. And he's certainly, you know, worked to contain government spending. And I think that has been the one unifying thing among all of these states is that the governors have really stressed fiscal responsibility and cutting back the size of government.
And they've made the case that their policies will lead to more jobs. I mean, we're talking about a period of time following the biggest, you know, recession since the Great Depression. These governors are tapping into something about how people feel. They want more jobs, especially in some of these Midwestern states where the industries have gone away.
Yeah, and they can point to some pretty good numbers. In Wisconsin, for example, the unemployment rate just recently came out, and it's 3.4%. It's the lowest it's been since April of 2000. Now, how much of that has to do with Wisconsin and Walker's policies versus the overall, you know, U.S. economy is sort of, you know, a point of contention. Sort of a balancing point to Walker's experiment in Wisconsin is neighboring Minnesota as well.
And Minnesota has a Democratic governor, Mark Dayton.
Exactly. And both states are doing reasonably well economically, although you can make the case that Minnesota is perhaps doing even better than Wisconsin in terms of diversity of its employment base and sort of the robustness and growth of its economy.
Now, it does seem that one issue was a step too far for Midwesterners in one of the more conservative Midwestern states, which would be Indiana. Now, Mike Pence, the vice president, was the governor of Indiana, and he wanted to push through the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 2015. The Indianapolis Tourism Bureau and others have said the law cost them tens of millions of dollars in lost business and gave the state a black eye on the national stage. And then Pence had to back off of that. Let's listen to him in a press conference in the midst of that controversy in 2015.
I don't believe for a minute that it was the intention of the General Assembly to create a license to discriminate or a right to deny services to gays, lesbians, or anyone else in this state. And it certainly wasn't my intent.
What did that moment mean, do you think?
Well, I think it was an example of how even in a conservative state, sometimes conservatives can press too far. And for Pence, that really ended up being a pretty bad situation in that he backtracked from it, which really angered social conservatives, both in Indiana and nationally. They felt really betrayed by him. A lot of people weren't following Pence's political career prior to when Donald Trump selected him to be his running mate, just right around the time of the Republican convention. But Pence was not doing so well in Indiana. His approval numbers were not great. He was not looking like necessarily a shoe-in for re-election. And some of that had to do with, the angering of social conservatives that he got involved with that particular issue.
Let's talk about Illinois, the state that you're in right now, my home state, a reliably blue state, but one with a Republican governor, billionaire Bruce Rauner, who has been in a stalemate with Illinois' democratically controlled legislature basically since he took office. Here's Rauner delivering his latest State of the State address in February.
When it comes to the budget, we all can agree Illinois has to do something different. Our administration has offered many proposals to achieve a truly balanced budget with changes that fundamentally fix our broken system. We must remember, this is critical, I ask, we've got to remember, to keep budgets balanced in the future, our rate of economic growth has to be higher than our rate of government spending growth. It's simple math.
How does Rauner fit into this world of Republican governors in the Midwest?
Yeah, he has been really stymied the entire time that he's been in office and is extremely vulnerable when it comes to re-election in 2018. He came into office wanting to sort of model himself towards Scott Walker in some respects. He wanted to be this, pro-business, low tax, we're going to reform government in Illinois and confront unions. And he has just been turned back at every opportunity by a democratically controlled legislature. And that was one thing, that Walker had going for him is, he had more Republican support in his state. And that had something to do with redistricting. But Rauner has just really accomplished very little. Credit ratings for the state have continually fallen. Rauner is in a terrible position for reelection. It's going to be challenging. He's got some very wealthy and well-known people in the Democratic primary already positioning to get to challenge him.
And if the Democrats do take back the governorship in Illinois, is that the start, do you think, of a turning of the tide in the Midwest, or is Illinois kind of unique?
I think Illinois is unique. Yeah. The state obviously had Republican governors in the past, but they tended to be more moderates. I think Illinois is a exception to the rule here in the Midwest when it comes to Republican governors.
So overall, when you look back at all of the things that these Republican governors have done in the Midwest, and we haven't even mentioned John Kasich in Ohio, Rick Snyder in Michigan, Terry Branstad in Iowa, what kind of an effect do you think that they've had on the nation?
Yeah, they've all had their sort of unique stories. And other than the efforts to try to balance budgets and rein in the size of government being the one sort of unifying thing, they've all had their own unique stories. Snyder in Michigan, had to deal with the Detroit bankruptcy, and which he got some credit for, but then came along the Flint water contamination situation, which really damaged him politically. In Ohio, Kasich, of course, had the distraction of a presidential campaign, but he, really has focused on sort of, state budgeting and trying to get the books in better shape there. But that has then in turn, put pressure on local governments, places like Cleveland that have had to deal with, financial situations because of the cut in state dollars. He's, obviously been a bit more of a moderate. He's, unique from Walker. And then in Iowa, Terry Branstad, the longest serving U.S. governor in history, he did sign a pretty extensive gun package that, among other things, will allow permit holders to carry guns in the Capitol. And, they've all sort of had their local issues to deal with. Some have had local crises to deal with. So they all have sort of different stories.
Well, and we should say that it's not just the Midwest where there are a lot of Republican governors. There are a lot of Republican governors across the entire country right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a sort of a golden opportunity for the Republicans. They control 33 governorships nationwide. It's the most since 1922. They also basically control 25 states right now. Republicans have unified control of the governorships and the legislature in half of the nation's states. And it's a few years down the road, but it will be very important. And it's one reason Republicans are where they are right now. Is redistricting. Republicans had some strong control after the 2010 census and when the 2011 redistricting was done. And so these next couple years will be very important in terms of who's going to control the redrawing of the maps after the 2020 census and sort of how the political landscape looks in this decade ahead. And so that's going to be really important. And it was a reason why the Republicans are where they are right now as well.
That's John McCormick, who's a reporter with Bloomberg based in Chicago. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Millions of people suffer from diabetes, and there are thousands of researchers around the world looking for a cure that would make daily life-saving injections of insulin a thing of the past. Well, one facility is in San Antonio, Texas. Wendy Rigby with Texas Public Radio explains the technique that's being designed is to make the body produce or regulate insulin on its own again.
A finger prick to check blood sugar levels. Dialing up the correct amount of insulin to inject.
Part of my daily routine all day and at night before I go to bed, all of it has to be done.
63-year-old type 2 diabetic Denise Schenck of Dallas has been a slave to this routine for 29 years. She's among millions of people who have to take injected insulin to control their blood sugar levels. Uncontrolled blood sugar can lead to kidney disease, amputation, blindness, heart disease, and death.
It's a pain and it's time-consuming. In other words, you can't just get up in the morning and put your clothes on and go somewhere.
And this becomes a big burden for diabetic patients. So it would be nice if they could just go around, not ever have to take another insulin injection, not ever have to do a finger stick for glucose.
That's Dr. Ralph DeFronzo. He's director of the Division of Diabetes at UT Health San Antonio. He and his colleague, biologist Bruno Droron, believe they are on to a gene transfer technique that will be a game changer. Using lab-created sections of DNA, scientists injected the pancreases of mice with a cocktail of three molecules containing genetic coding delivered by a virus. That virus infects the cells, spreading the new gene information and sparking those cells to produce insulin, sort of like a cold virus makes your nose run, DeFronzo says.
Basically, what we're going to do is we're going to give you a runny pancreas. We're going to put the genes in the pancreas, and the runniness is you're going to now release the insulin.
Unlike injections of insulin, the insulin produced using gene therapy corrects minute to minute based on what you eat and how it affects your blood sugar. Biologist Warren says the research results exceeded expectations.
We're able to cure a mice model for more than 1 year without any side effects. We're thinking that it could be permanent, yes.
In humans, the therapy could be introduced using endoscopy, where an instrument inserted through the throat reaches the pancreas. The new molecules would be inserted directly to the organ itself through a catheter. For type 1 patients, a potential cure. DeFronzo says type 2 patients would still have to take a pill to correct for insulin resistance.
if you only had to take one pill, even if you were type 2 and you could get rid of the insulin, that would be a huge, huge advance and make life a lot easier for these people.
The San Antonio study was published in the journal Current Pharmaceutical Biotechnology. Scientists received a patent in January, and they're forming a spin-off company from UT Health to commercialize the breakthrough treatment if and when it wins approval from the Food and Drug Administration. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio.
And this program note, later today in All Things Considered, the CEO of United Airlines is testifying today on Capitol Hill. The topic, customer service and what happens when an airline removes passengers to accommodate staff. One lawmaker told United's Oscar Munoz that you made your problem the customer's problem when United forcibly removed passenger David Dow from a plane last month. Well, we'll have that story later today on All Things Considered.
A new report from Symantec finds that 1.1 billion accounts were breached last year. That's double the number for the previous year. So what do you do if it happens to you, if you get hacked? Suku Nair is a professor of computer science and engineering at Southern Methodist University. Professor, thanks for joining us.
You are welcome, and thank you for this opportunity to talk to you.
Well, and let me start by asking whether most people who have been hacked know that they've been hacked. Is it obvious?
No, it is not. You know, it depends on, you know, what kind of hack you are going through, especially if your computer is hacked and you did not see any changes in your email or your experiences. You know, sometimes, you know, people don't realize it. But there could be a virus or a malware in the system, you know, which could be stealing a lot of confidential information from your system, including your passwords. You know, when you type in on the keyboard, they could be reading every character that you are typing in. Hmm. But, for example, if it's a hack on the email, you know, you may notice it.
And what are the signs that you could look for if that is happening to you and you don't notice it? Are there things that would be red flags?
Oh, absolutely. Most of the time, you know, people realize about a hack on the email by getting some information from their friends saying that, hey, I got this funny email from you. Quite likely your email is hacked. Or sometimes, you know, you may not be able to get into your email. You know, you may think you are typing in the right password. First couple of times, you may think you mistyped it, but you try again, and then you cannot get in. That means somebody else hacked into your system and changed your password. Or sometimes you get into the email, then you may not see all your contacts. Or sometimes you will see some funny changes in your file structure and those kind of things. You know, so there are things, you know, noticeable when there is an email hack.
And is the responsibility for the hack in part on you? Is the user doing something that they shouldn't be doing or not being careful enough about how they're using their system?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it responsibility, but unfortunately, most of the time the hacks happen because of carelessness from the user.
Carelessness like what? What would the user be doing?
First of all, you know, they should be using good passwords. And then even if they use good passwords, they should be changing the password on a regular basis. And they should not share the password with other people. You know, they should not paste the good password on your screen. These are all a few things that you can definitely do.
What about using public Wi-Fi? Is that a risk?
It is a risk. You know, you have to be very careful. Quite often when you go to this public Wi-Fi, you may not even know whether you are connecting to a legit base station. You know, there are people who will come there and set up their own base stations and give even a stronger signal to your device so that you may think that is the right one and you will connect it. And then when you connect there, you may be logging into your email or you may be logging into your bank. All those places, you know, quite often they can steal your credentials.
Hmm. Now, if it is your email that's hacked, and a lot of people in this country, as you know, use email from tech companies like Google or Yahoo or Microsoft, often those accounts are free. One of the things I was surprised by is that if there's a problem, let's say you get locked out of your account, you have really no power as a consumer of one of these free services. There is no 1-800 number for Gmail, for example.
That's very true, and that is the premise that we are going to tread, you know, when we have this free services. You know, there used to be a time, you know, when you pay big money for your phone connection or email service, if there is any kind of service downtime, you can immediately contact them and alert them, and they will send a truck and fix it. But now things are kind of centralized and free, And because of that, the service is also kind of coming down. But having said that, they always give information out in terms of how to keep it safe. And nowadays, if you are hacked into, quite likely there are many people who are experiencing similar thing, and you can always go to another computer or another place and then search for, okay, this happened to me, what do I do? So much information out there. So that's how we are counterbalancing that issue of lack of customer service.
So what is the one thing that you would say people should do to protect themselves from this kind of thing?
Well, like I said, definitely use strong passwords and keep changing them. And if you detect any kind of compromise on your email, you have to change the password immediately. But then again, there is a caveat. If you find the email is compromised, you should try to change the password from a different computer. Don't do it from the same computer, because you don't know exactly how your email has been compromised. If there is a virus in your system, then if you're changing the password on your computer, then they can get that new password also. So you should go to a different computer and try to change it. And then you should change the password for all other online accounts you have.
I have to push back on you, though, a little bit, because you know how annoying that is.
It is annoying. Yeah, it is annoying. And that's exactly what the attackers, they're counting on. Even when information is out there, okay, this is happening, you have to change it, people just don't change it. And it is so surprising to me that even when the danger is there, insecurity, it's almost like healthcare. Even when we know that certain practices are going to make you more vulnerable, you always think it will happen only to your neighbor, not to you.
And when it does happen to you, it is really much worse, I think, than you even expect.
That is the thing. That's the thing, But, it's a human behavior. And because of that, we will always have security issues. I tell my students, cybersecurity is almost like getting into neurosurgery. You will never get the satisfaction of completely curing somebody. At the same time, you have a lot of job security. It is going to be there all the time.
That's Suku Nair, Southern Methodist University professor of computer science and engineering. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, one wonders if someone has hacked the fashion industry. Have you seen Nordstrom's dirty jeans? How about Reebok's pre-sweaty t-shirt? Maybe it's a joke, but they sold out. Veronique Hyland is the fashion editor for New York Magazine's The Cut. Veronique, start with the PRPS Barracuda straight leg jeans with fake mud that won't wash out that sell for $425.
I know. I mean, it seems kind of absurd, but you have to think about, people pay for jeans that are ripped and t-shirts that are intentionally threadbare. So that's just sort of the ne plus ultra of this overall trend.
But people who actually do work are, having a field day with this. Mike Rowe, who's the former host of TV's Dirty Jobs, he posted on Facebook, they're a costume for wealthy people who see work as ironic, not iconic. They're saying things like, my husband has jeans like this he's been wasting on car repair.
Yeah.
This is not going over well with those people who think they're either being mocked or somebody's getting away with looking like they really do hard work when they don't.
Right. You see fashion kind of making these often, at best, politically incorrect, at worst, offensive missteps all the time. Think of John Galliano's collection for Dior that was called the Homeless Collection, where he had models wrapped in newspaper. Fashion oftentimes will draw from sort of the lowliest segments of society and try to elevate them, and that can be really problematic.
Yeah, because some people reduce to rip off, ripped off.
Yeah.
In the meantime, you've got Reebok, which has come out with their own sweat-stained T-shirts, also for
$425. Well, I think that was a parody of the jeans, not meant to be like a serious product.
Right. Yeah, they call this the authentic sweatshirt created by company employees, putting in the hard work for you and giving you a pre-sweated tee for that post-workout look and smell.
Yeah, and when I first saw it, and I wasn't sure if it was real or not, it didn't seem like so far-fetched to me that there would be a pre-sweated shirt, because that is kind of the point that we're at. But this is not new. Every time there's a new Yeezy collection, people always say that it looks like, Walking Dead chic.
Well, that, of course, is Kanye West that you're referring to.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, did not go to last night's extraordinary Met Gala. Otherwise, we might have seen some of these things there.
Yeah.
But just, was there one outfit that you saw that wasn't the sort of gorgeous classic with the long trains, but something that maybe is a part of this fashion that you're talking about?
The designer Rei Kawakubo is the subject of the exhibition at the Costume Institute. And I think that the two people who did it best were Rihanna. Everyone was talking about what she wore, this unbelievable creation of flowers. And Caroline Kennedy, the former ambassador to Japan, also wore a Comme des Garçons look. And I thought the two of them did it really well. You know, it was a challenging theme. And I think the people who tried to sort of approximate what Rei Kawakubo does had a much more difficult time.
Don't try. If you can't compete, don't try.
Yeah.
Veronique Hyland, the fashion editor for New York Magazine's The Cut, thank you.
Thank you.
The movie The Circle did not do well at the box office in its first week of release. It earned just $9 million. But the story behind the movie, written by Dave Eggers, is resonating in Silicon Valley. In the film, college grad Mae Holland, played by Emma Watson, is hired by the tech giant The Circle, a company with wide-reaching goals and products that aim to change the world for the better. Goals like this one.
Why not stop duplicating services? Why not just make it all part of one unified system? You could pay your taxes, vote, pay your parking ticket, all through your Circle account. We'd save users hundreds of hours of inconvenience. We'd save the government billions.
Well, who better to talk about the world of fictional tech than our weekly guide to the world of real tech, Recode? Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode. He joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, and first, set this up for us. Mae Holland is a college grad hoping to make her way in the world, and she ends up at this company called The Circle, which is kind of a combination of Facebook, Google, and Amazon.
All in one.
Right.
So I think the book what the book attempts to do is to, you know, ultimately skewer what Eggers sees as sort of the very problematic march towards, you know, corporate subjugation, right? That everyone needs to sort of – it's easier. It's cheaper, right? So if we all just sort of use that same system for everything in our lives, your lives would be better. At the same time, I mean, the dark side to that, of course, is that you are subject to this company
right.
that controls and owns all of your data, all of your information.
And in the story, the company has something called True You, which is essentially like having one login for everything you do. Not exactly an unrealistic idea, is it?
It's not. In fact, this is exactly the thing that, you know, Google, Facebook, Apple, any sort of big tech company out there, Amazon, that they're all trying to work on. They all have identities for people, your Apple ID or your Amazon Prime account, for example, your Facebook for that matter. And they would like it if that could sort of, you know, kind of rule everything, right? Your entire life. Use that login for anything you want to do.
What about the product called Sea Change? This is also in the book. It uses light portable cameras, which broadcast everything you do. And let's listen to another clip here. The main character, Mae Holland, becomes the guinea pig for this.
From now on, I'll be wearing a modified Sea Change camera at all times. I'm going fully transparent.
Now, I read this book a few years ago, and when I did, that seemed a bit far off. Now, I'm thinking Facebook Live. That's exactly what that is.
That and, you know, Twitter's also trying to do this, some version of that. I think a lot of these big companies are also investing in things like drones and cameras altogether that in the service of that idea that I want to collect as much data about you, not to sort of be this evil corporate overlord, but I can serve you better. You know, if I know more about what you're doing, then I can give you better stuff. I can give you more relevant stuff.
So do people in Silicon Valley believe that we've reached the point of the circle or that we're close to reaching the point of what happens in the circle, or how are they reacting to this?
Well, so it's interesting is that the culture of Silicon Valley is the cultural beat, so to speak, is that they don't really pay attention to the works like this, unfortunately, right? So, you know, even if they believe that we're kind of achieve this level that you're seeing in the circle, they're, you know, which they largely do, they can't wait for it to happen. You know, they want it to happen. That's the difference, right? That they think there isn't enough of a differentiation between the work of art and the reality of it. And I think in a weird way, the work of art actually doesn't go far enough, right? Mm. I think it's too close and it reads almost like a fairy tale that you're just sort of like, it's either easy to dismiss or it doesn't do enough to actually skewer the industry because it's not making it more apparent to the industry itself. I think that's the tricky part of all this.
One thing I think it definitely gets right is this idea among people who work in Silicon Valley and work in the tech industry these days that everything they're doing is for the betterment of society, and which can be a dangerous way of thinking, because if it's, you know, think about Google's don't be evil slogan, you know,
right.
It's like, yeah, except when maybe you do something that people see as evil.
And that's the thing. I think it's ultimately naive, right? I think it's a nice sentiment, but you all work for companies that want to make a profit, right? That is the true motivation underlying anything. And I think that the profits are so fat for a lot of these companies, companies like Google and Apple, it's easy to sort of just kind of get lost in a little bit of, you know, hey, I'm going to try to make the world better, and your boss will give you the time to do it in case that becomes a big profit maker in the future. That's a nice situation to be in, certainly. But I think at the same time, it's naive for a lot of engineers to think that somehow, oh, you know what, this is going to change the world. It might, but not because you necessarily want to, but because the company can afford to do.
Is there any fear in Silicon Valley that there's going to be some kind of regulation put on it that will make it more difficult for it to do the things that we see happen in the circle?
Yes, there absolutely is fear around that, but it goes beyond just U.S. borders. Like, they've got bigger fish to fry. You know, Facebook, Google, Apple, they've got bigger issues in the EU and China and trying to operate there. So
right. It's
a much bigger problem than whatever regulations or whatever kind of concerns the U.S. government might have. They see it as a global issue.
That's Ed Lee, a managing editor at Recode. Ed, thanks so much.
Anytime.
And Here It Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.